Culture with me, Robert Bound, was first broadcast on the 30th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Culture with Robert Bound, brought to you by Mercedes-Benz. Hello and welcome to the 16th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we'll be keeping a straight face as we fly through the next 60 minutes contemplating comedy. Funny ha-ha, not funny weird, although I'm sure there might be a bit of that too. I'll be joined in the studio by British comedian Andy Osho, Bruce Hill, COO of the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal, comedy agent Brett Vincent and Chris Ritchie, who lectures on the Comedy Writing and Performance course at the University of Solent, thought to be the only course of its kind in the world.
There's a discipline and a skill in communicating an idea in a funny way, and some people can do it and some people can't.
We'll also be heading down to London's South Bank to enjoy the inaugural Comedy Film Festival.
The whole atmosphere of the festival is about recognising how difficult it is to make comedy, and everyone has repeatedly said today that all good comedy films have every single quality of all the best films that have ever been made, plus they have to make people laugh, otherwise they fail.
And if that weren't enough, we're off to celebrate the imminent apocalypse at an exhibition showcasing some political cartoons for 2012 in Arlington, Virginia.
You know, everybody's trying to make a point. The thing the cartoonists do differently is they try to make a serious point in a funny way.
Plus a mad minute of sound as we go on the road with stand-up comedian James Mullinger. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Quite a lot to look forward to in this hopefully humorous offering from us here on The Culture Show. But first, let's have a song from my album of the week, Imaginary Future. This is French Films with You Don't Know. And they're not from Brooklyn, they're not even from Manchester, they're from Helsinki, that is French Films with You Don't Know. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. This is Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're talking all things funny in the land of comedy. I'm joined in the studio by British comedian Andy Osho, an increasingly familiar face on British TV and radio, comedy agent Brett Vincent, who represents a variety of acts, including Glenn Wool and Jason John Whitehead, and Dr. Chris Ritchie, who lectures on the Comedy Writing and Performance course at the University of Solent, thought to be the only one of its kind in the world. Welcome all to the show.
Thank you.
And also all the way from Montreal, we're joined on the line by Bruce Hills, COO of the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
This sounds very smooth. I'm glad that this is all going smoothly. Bruce, we'll kick off with you in your studio in Montreal. The Just for Laughs Comedy Festival looms large over the world of comedy. But for those of our international audience, maybe who don't know what it is and what a big deal it is, could you give us a little potted history of what it is and what part it plays in sort of comedy commissioning and getting names launched on the international stage?
Absolutely. Well, Just for Laughs is going into its 30th year this summer, this July in Montreal. It takes place every year in July and has really been, I think, for a lot of international acts, a entree into the North American comedy world and especially, you know, the Hollywood side of things. So that's been an important focus of ours. A lot of British comics have launched here, you know, everyone from Rowan doing Mr. Bean for an audience that didn't know him to Eddie Izzard. All the way to Lee Evans and others over the years. Also, of course, Hollywood has to come to Montreal to launch Hollywood stars. So, you know, you've got Tim Allen and Ray Romano and Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld that have done this festival at an important part in their career. Some have benefited more than others. You know, in addition to being a big industry hub where show business folks exchange ideas and book talent, we are first and foremost an event for the punter. You know, we sell close to 500,000 tickets, and we have another 1 million in the street to come and watch free shows. So very important for us to sort of create a balance between a marketplace and a great ticket for a fan to buy great comedy ticket at a reasonable price. So we try to bring both worlds together and at the end of the day find some way of funding it. It's probably been the most influential comedy festival in that period of time. Not the only one. There's other fantastic events around the world. We just sort of have our part and we play that part. I think as time's moved on, and I would ask Brett to agree or disagree with this, is that we've been able to combine an audience with the appropriate act much better. So if someone's a very quirky, British act, even with an accent that can be challenging, we've done a better job of matching them with an appropriate audience in Montreal. We didn't do it as well 10, 15 years ago, but now I think we really figured out how to draw a smart young audience to see some of the breakout British talent and give them a chance to succeed versus just plopping them on a TV gala 20 years ago and then watch them fail miserably because it wasn't a venue that they were going to succeed at unless they were very, very lucky.
All right, well, we can ask Brett that, luckily enough, because he's right here. Now, a lot of the things that Bruce was saying, Brett, there's a lot of business, and there's a serious side of comedy, isn't there? I mean, as an agent yourself, you obviously have spanning these two worlds like Bruce's between genuinely finding someone funny and wanting to book them or take them onto your books and having to think about the bottom line at the same time.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with Bruce. I think one of my first acts, Jim Jefferies, was out in Montreal, I think it was 2006, and he's gone on from there. He was complete unknown. He was booked from a tape, which I think he was one of the first ever comedians to be booked from a tape without any of the bookers being off to see him. And he went over and did the Nasty Show. From them, I think he got basically a lot of publicity, he got a lot of press, a lot of heat, and now he's living in America. He's got his own TV series out there. He comes over here and into the UK and tours big venues. And I suppose one of his breaking points was going over to Montreal and being a part of the Nasty Show and playing to some great crowds every single night. So.
And just last then, is it's sort of one of those, it's a happy medium perhaps between being, like if it was a rock festival, it was going to be somewhere between Glastonbury and a sort of corporate-y event, then it's got a bit of both. You've got all the executives there, but you've also got a lot of paying punters.
Yeah, I think there's something for everything. I mean, my side and the stuff that I like is the stuff like The Nasty Show. And
you have to tell our listeners what The Nasty Show is.
I think Bruce...
Nasty Show is pretty well described in the title alone, yeah. But it is basically a grouping of the... the edgier, ruder comics all in one show. We find at times that if we throw, the first time ever Jim Jefferies and tell him to be himself on a show where the audience doesn't know what they're expecting, Jim's going to walk away and go, why the hell did I do that? Because, I wasn't able to be myself. So what we always try to do is find outlets for acts to be themselves. If that's an edgy comic from Australia in the case of Jim Jefferies, or let's be honest, a black comedian from America, I want that act to be able to perform and be themselves, not to have to edit themselves down to something where they succeed or fail based on altering who they are, because that usually leads to a bad experience for everyone, and the act leaves with a bad taste in their mouth. So,
yeah. All right, well, let's ask Andy and Chris as well. Nasty seems to be a bit of a trend, certainly on British TV, and obviously it's a big hit that seems to be the hot ticket at the Montreal Festival as well. Do you have to be nasty to be funny? Is it the easiest way to kind of kick off to make a bit of a stir, Andy? I mean, your act is not that, is it? But is it easy? Is it the lowest common denominator? Is there something wiser beyond that?
I don't think so. I mean, I think sometimes the shock can get a laugh, but I think beyond that, I think you have to have written some decent jokes. If they happen to be on a subject that is quote-unquote nasty, then, that's just what's funny. It's still got to be delivered with aplomb and, there needs to be some good writing at the bottom of it.
And Chris, on your course, when you lecture in comedy at Solent, do you find people kind of jockeying for position in order to sort of be the new... We'll mention maybe someone like Frankie Boyle, who seems to have changed his act quite a lot. For our international listeners, he's a Scottish comedian who does some pretty off-colour jokes, and whether or not they're funny is up to the three of you to decide, not for me, luckily. But do lots of people come on to the class and sort of want to out-rude each other?
Yeah, I think so, because it's the easiest way of getting a laugh is to shock, but it's difficult to be original and shocking. There's a whole bunch of rape jokes and paedophile jokes knocking around at the moment, and they're not that good. Like Andy says, it's the quality of the writing that determines the ultimate reception. With any comedian, it's got to be written well and original, not just shocking. Yeah, it's the art of comedy is creating a new spin on something that everybody knows or has done before, and that's quite hard.
If you're going to teach your students or lecture your students, where does it begin? Does it begin with a piece of pen and a paper or standing up on stage?
Well, they have to, or the students who come on the degree are already doing the stand-up or are passionate about it. You know, we don't teach them to be funny. They're funny already. But what we do is say, well, you know, there's another way of doing it. And, you know, have you thought about the ethical point of view when you're doing these kind of...
There's a health and safety element to all this, kids.
There is. Well, it's the problem with shock is that you tend to forget an ethical stance. And would you say the same thing to your mates in the pub or at home or whatever as you do on the stage? Is it an honest point of view, or are you just doing it because it's a shocker, you know?
Brett, I mean, when you take on acts, you always sort of see behind the smoke screen of rudeness?
Well, I think actually being like rude and being that dark in the way of Jim Jefferies, Frankie Boyle, I suppose you can add Brendan Burns, Doug Stanhope, all these kind of like edgier comedians into a ball. But I think that's one of the hardest things to do. I think observational comedy sometimes is possibly the easiest in a way of standing up to do. And looking back at this is, do you remember when... kind of jokes. I mean, when I'm purely looking for originality in new comedians, and I mean, that's one of the things that there isn't really much of breaking through at the moment. Yes, there's a lot more comedians, but you can always say, well, he's very much like that person, or they're very much like that person. And it's actually trying to find that originality or someone who's naturally funny in a way. I think there is people that are naturals in comedy, like the likes of, I'm going to go back to Jim as well, and people like Andrew Maxwell, I've never seen them write a joke down. They've just basically taken something that's happened to them in the everyday life and just told it on stage, and just the way that they tell it is naturally funny. But then there is other people who will sit there for hours and hours and hours and start with a punchline and work backwards, or just start with an idea and continuously write and rewrite and edit and edit and edit a joke until they've finally got it. So there's different ways of doing it, but when I'm looking for it, I do go out to the clubs probably three times a week now, and I enjoy the audience reaction sometimes than actually picking apart someone's material and just basically watching how well the audience reacts and how well the comedian is reacting to the audience.
Well, Andy, what's your working practice? Do you write things on the back of your hand? Do you write them on a piece of paper, or do they just come as flashes of inspiration like poetry in the night?
I write them on the back of an audience member's hand and then incorporate them in the act. I think that's the easiest way to do it. No, I've tried lots of different ways. I mean, some stuff gets formed in the moment. People talk about, you know, writing on stage, and you've got an idea, you don't quite know where it's going, so you just talk it out in front of the audience, which is a high-risk strategy. But sometimes you just find some, you know, some really nice stuff, especially if you're really emotionally engaged with what you're saying. Like, I was doing a bit the other day about, you know, dating websites where guys talk about going travelling and saying how they love nights in and nights out, and how you see that a lot on loads of... And I just started talking it through, and I was really sort of... quite worked up, quite angry talking about it in front of the audience, and just found loads of nice little, you know, punchlines, tags and stuff like that for the joke that if I'd been sat down, I don't think you can always write a rant if you're just sat at a desk or typing or whatever. But I'm also, you know, I'll sort of wake up in the middle of the night and just have a fully formed joke that I have to write down, you know, so I've got, you know, notepad by my bed or a stack of post-it notes because I know this is going to happen. I sort of expect it now that instead of, you know, the joke's letting me have a peaceful night's sleep, they just sort of knock on the door and go, we need to be written down, please. So, you know, so I do that as well.
The nuit blanche, that's what they call it when you have an inspiration in the middle of the night, don't they? And you never mind losing sleep because
there's
you've got an amazing idea.
It's a nuit blanche.
The French call it a white night, and it sounds a bit rude than it is, but basically, it's not a wet dream, it is. Waking is having a great idea in the middle of the night, and that's that. Bruce Hills can translate that for us. Bruce? I wanted to actually ask you, on the subject of the clairvoyant role, presumably, I was asking Brett about this, as you heard, but the clairvoyant role of the agent or of someone like you in charge of Just for Laughs, do you kind of feel that you kind of get the long view of the trends in comedy, observational comedy, more of the rude stuff, or stuff that's made a bit more actorly and a bit more written? Do you have a telescope or a microscope in charge of Just for Laughs?
Well, listen, I just hire smart people to do my scouting and thing. No, but you know what? I agree with Brad. I mean, the challenge is to find originality. That's what we're always looking for. And especially with the passing of so many great comics in the last year or two, you know, you just wake up and you say, you know, we don't have Patrice O'Neill, Greg Giraldo, and Mitch Hedberg anymore, and where are we going to find these new voices? And that's the thing that always worries me, because what resonates with our festival audiences and with Brett and others that come, and even other comics, is for them to find that next new voice in comedy. It always worries me that we're not going to find that person, and what is the next thing we need to focus on at Just for Laughs, because we want to be on the cutting edge. We want to present something before everyone else. And at the very least, we want to make sure that we have smart, original comics at our festival. If not, we fail.
All right, Bruce. Well, Chris, Bruce is worried. Can you help him out? You presumably, of all of us, can come to the rescue. Are you on the sort of scout for originality? You say you know when people walk into your lecture theatre that you can sort of tell if they're funny or not, or they already are, or they're sort of half a formed sort of comedian.
Well, when we interview the students, they have to bring in work, and you can tell straight away if somebody's can write a joke. If you can see the comic idea and they've kind of getting towards it or stumbling towards it, and so we may consider them. There's other students who come in and have just got like 2.5 pages of great one-liners, so we'll have that. And there's other people who just haven't got a clue. They're funny in the pub, or the mates think they're funny, but that's not the same as writing. There's a discipline and a skill in communicating a joke, an idea in a funny way, and some people can do it and some people can't.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where I'm joined in the studio by comedian Andy Osho, Bruce Hills from the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal, and comedy agent Brett Vincent. You guessed the theme, it's funny, ha ha. We'll be hearing more from them in a bit. Stay with us.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary
to see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers, and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel, and we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies, and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, and I think it's time for another song. It's almost as if this were a comedy special.
Listen to me, let them be happy, don't you ever wear a front. Don't let the bastard drive you down.
And that is a song that always puts a smile on your face. Laugh and Be Happy by Randy Newman. Ha ha. Still to come in part two, we'll be continuing our comedy discussion, seeing what films have got people laughing at the London Comedy Film Festival, and indulging in some satirical genius at the Apocalyptoon political cartoon exhibition in Arlington, Virginia, plus 60 seconds of stand-up heaven, stand-up hell. They'll be here on Culture with me, Robert Bound. So it's our comedy special today, and I'm here in the studio with stand-up comic Andy Osho, comedy lecturer Dr. Chris Ritchie, comedy agent Brett Vincent, and joining us on the line from Montreal is Bruce Hills, boss of the Just for Laughs Festival.
We're going to go and play now. We did a little bit of research. We found out that the funniest joke at the Edinburgh Comedy Festival last year...
Was it Tim Vine? It's usually Tim Vine.
Is it Tim Vine?
Was it?
Possibly Nick Helm, I think, got it last year.
Oh, really?
Nick
Helm?
Oh.
Or Dan Antopolsky.
Was it me? Let it be me.
The prize was awarded last year to Nick Helm for the following. I needed a password 8 characters long, so I picked Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. That's an internet password, presumably, which is quite funny. So what we did, we thought we'd give our correspondents a piece of recording kit. We went to Berlin and we went to Tokyo. And this is what we discovered, whether or not comedy travels.
Ich brauchte ein Passwort 8 Zeichen lang, damit ich Schneewittchen und die Sieben Zwerge abholte.
Do you understand what that means?
Can I translate it into English? Maybe it makes more sense then. I needed a password, 8 characters long. Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Okay, but it doesn't work in German.
Okay, why?
Because characters means, in German it's Zeichen, and this means sign.
Okay.
Because, a sign or, yeah. So it doesn't work in German, but it's funny.
あるものにパスワードが必要で、しかもキャラクター8つで構成されてないといけないというから、悩んだ挙句、白雪姫と七人の小人にしました。
いや、難しい。難しいな、本当に。笑うポイントが、ポイントがわからないです。笑うポイントが。言いたいことはわかるんですけど。
All right, that was a piece of experimental radio more than anything else.
Yeah, I like that German, ha 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 ha, yeah. Yes, this is funny.
I don't know whether that was an ironic laugh. Well, I think that it sounded like that laugh was also written down on someone's, of an audience member's hand as well. Right?
You probably don't know this, but there is a bilingual comedy scene in Berlin. There's nights that are done in English by English-speaking comedians and nights done in German by German and foreign comedians as well. And it's kind of taken on, it's got the history of the cabaret thing from the 20s and having that political and satirical kind of aspect. So it kind of undermines this rather tedious idea that Germans have no sense of humour. I'm standing up for the Germans here.
Do it.
Because everybody has a sense of humour. It's just expressed in a different way. Just because they don't make jokes like us doesn't mean to say they don't have a sense of humour.
I wanted to ask Bruce, you mentioned Eddie Izzard right back in the beginning of the show. He performed the same show in French, as I say, that he performed in English, which presumably went down well at Montreal. There's not much of a trend for this, is there? I mean, is it purely because most people aren't bilingual, or is it because you find, in your experience, that jokes don't carry?
Well, I mean, first of all, Eddie seems to want to do his comedy in every language. The next language he's going to try is German, and so we'll see how that goes. But, you know, Eddie really... He dug in his heels in Paris, and he went in there and spent his days learning French and then doing a show for 3 months in Paris. It ended up being a big hit. I wouldn't say it's a trend, but for us, trying to find a way to communicate what we do to other countries, it's been a challenge to try to figure out, can we bring over comics that don't speak English and find an audience for them in their native language? And we've had some success. You know, last year we did a show partly in German. We got an audience that was bilingual, and we had a Chinese artist come over and speak Mandarin in a major show. Again, largely a Mandarin-speaking audience that showed up for it. So I wouldn't say it's a trend, but I will say that in countries like Germany, they are, in some countries in the Netherlands, they're looking to broadcast English comedy with and without subtitles and see if it will connect to, you know, the people, the comedy fans in those countries, because they, for the most part, do understand English.
Telling a joke, telling it well, is the ultimate sort of art of communication. And so it's about knowing the minutiae of the language, whether it's your own tongue or whether you've adopted somebody else's, presumably. Andy, that's something that is a rapport with an audience, that means is the ultimate flirtation. It's the ultimate relationship you can build from strangers to people eating out of the palm of your hand, or you reading off the back of theirs.
Oh, reading off the... Yeah, exactly. The interesting one is where you get acts every now and again who deliberately lose the audience. Or do not necessarily that they're trying to lose the audience, but they don't care about having them on side. And it's quite intoxicating sometimes if it's managed well. And that's a really sort of tricky tightrope to walk, actually, doing
I'm thinking
that.
Someone like Stuart Lee.
Neil Hamburger.
Yeah, right. Perhaps. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm way too insecure for any of that stuff.
to be loved.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, come on. And it needs to happen right from the top. but it's interesting is, like, when you start out as well, like, the audience don't know you. They might never have seen you before at another comedy club. They've never seen you on TV or whatever. And so you literally are going from cold to building up that rapport, and it's and you acquire skills quite quickly to know how to sort of get them on board as quickly as you can, so that you can then get to do your jokes.
So
that
tell
you know
us, let us into the mind, the tortured mind of the stand-up comedian, Andy, and tell us what these tricks are that you would use at the top.
Just, I don't know. I mean, my way of doing it is just being super up tempo, buoyant, whatever. And yeah, I like to have a little banter with the audience as well. And I always think it's really important get that first joke out early, like let it be short and let it be good, and it's like a blitzkrieg almost of a joke, get it out, and then the audience sort of trust you, and then it gives you a little bit of space to relax into your routine. Because I get tense when I'm watching someone on stage and they start with a really long story and there's been no jokes and the audience haven't laughed, and the longer you leave that, the less likely the audience is to trust in you. And the longer you leave it, the better the joke's got to be as well, the better the punchline's got to be.
Well, Chris, what do you think? I mean, do audiences want some slow build-up, some foreplay, or they want to go straight in for the climax?
You've got to prove that you're funny. Give it 30 seconds, get straight in and say, I'm funny, here's a gag, usually on a general subject, and then you can bring in the personal. But you've got to appeal to the general mindset of the audience before bringing in your angle. And also, what Andy's saying about the like rambling on, the strength of the punchline is what justifies how long you've been rambling on. If you ramble on for 5 minutes and it's a fairly feeble pun, then the audience have the right to stab you.
So you've got to know the power of what you've got in your pocket.
Yeah, you know, the build up to the punchline has to be nicely balanced. Otherwise, it's just boring.
And is this an art form that drives people mad? Because there is such a perfection, there is such a minute. I mean, it's like being an actor and it's like being a writer all at the same time, isn't it?
I don't know if it makes them mad. I think they're mad in the first place.
That's why they go into it.
Yeah. But I think
Brett's basically trying not to talk about the number of showbiz demises that he's probably been in charge of.
No.
And Bruce, taking the long view from Montreal, do you see that sort of characters, people blowing the line between their on-stage persona and their off-stage persona? We're taught, I suppose, to think that comedians are sad people off stage. You're in a good position to be to know about that, because I've heard that the parties at Just for Laughs are fairly legendary and they go on for days. What's the truth?
Well, in terms of, are they sad people off stage or?
Yes, indeed. And how many of the on stage acts follow these performers off stage?
Are you just checking, Bruce, just to make sure that you don't get sued
exactly.
by anybody?
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, you know, for certain. You know, there are a lot of people that are not the bright spirit on that they are on stage when they get backstage. They're very, very concerned and nervous, especially in our situation, because we're not the normal gig. There's a lot at stake, so we always find people are if they are neurotic and difficult, well, they're going to be on a special alert from Montreal. So it's important to create the best environment for them. And you know, you're talking about. You need gags, or you know, what do you do with the quiet spots in people's sets? You know, our advice always when you're doing television is you've got to gain momentum. If you're not known, you've got to come in there, you've got to gain some momentum right away. You can play once you got them, but you're really risking a lot if you're going to play before you got them.
Before we go, I wanted to ask whether with all the different media available to us now, whether it's easier to make it. Chris, do you dispatch your students on the way of YouTube and just tell them to practice and get stuff out there, or is TV still the be-all and end-all?
The TV is the be-all and end-all. Everybody wants to be on TV, but the way that you get on TV is by working and working and working on the stand-up circuit. Mm. That's where, like, producers and managers and all that hang out. That's how you get noticed. You know, it would be nice to make a career of just writing, but most people don't, and they've got to be up there on the stage and maintain a public presence as well as an internet presence as well.
Brett, do you find that you're having to push people harder and get them to kind of be on Twitter and be kind of making themselves available and being funny in a variety of different media?
Yeah, I think it's crucial. I think I was one of the first agents in 2005 to have a YouTube site and everything.
Did you win an award for something, a multimedia flyer? Don't pretend you don't know.
There's been so many now.
Oh, that old thing. Whatever.
Initiative, yeah. A few bits and pieces, but yeah. You have to push on with technology, and you have to find, be it Twitter, be it Bebo, that was back in the day, Bebo, MySpace, then Facebook, now Twitter, I suppose Foursquare is coming in now, and there's so many other different kind of networking that is coming up. And I think if you look at Dane Cook and MySpace, he garnered, I think it was 4 million people in a certain amount of days, and he'd put his tickets on sale just on MySpace and would sell out within a couple of hours with his whole tour just through that. So, I mean, I think it's crucial in this day and age.
I mean, are comedians hardworking enough to do that? I mean, do people think they're funny? They're told they're funny. There's ego in comedy. I'm not looking at Andy. Do people tend to respond well when they know that their good career is at the end of it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them do crave attention, and there is some people on Twitter who I just kind of go, you've really tweeted 27,000 times. And quite a few comedians there that are on there way too much. And some of them, like especially some of the younger ones, that take it way too seriously and want to see how many retweets they've had and how many this and that, and I think that their comedy career is building off the back of that. Like, we see the back end of it, in a way. Like, with a Facebook page or with a website, we see how many hits they get. Yeah. Like, if they've been on radio, then we kind of say, okay, well, then they've had another 1,000 hits or something like that. So it's good for us to have this kind of information and find out exactly how many people are seeing. And I mean, nowadays you can find out that there's 25 people in Israel now tuned into your Facebook page. And so everything is split up so easily. And it's good to have these demographics and everything, so coming into the game and just finding out, especially with YouTube and Facebook and all these people telling you exactly where your audience is, you can then go and cater for it. So
Brett's all over the facts, isn't he? But apparently, Andy, comedians also have an ego.
I don't know what this, I don't know where this has come from. We just want to make people laugh and have them love us. I was just going to add as well, just about this whole thing of TV being the be all and end all. I've been very lucky in that I've had TV exposure, but I don't think it is the be all and end all. I think that at the root of everything is stand up. And there's loads of stand ups who've, for one reason or another, decided not to go down that road, who intentionally don't do TV. And I think the joy for me as stand-up is the live, you know, just connecting with the live audience, because you don't know what's going to happen. You know what you intend to have happen, i.e. I'm going to do an hour and a half show or whatever, but who knows what, you know, audiences are going to say when you chat with them or whatever random thing is going to occur. So I think that if comics are aiming towards TV, then great, but I don't think they should make it absolutely their only goal. There's so many different outlets. You can be a touring comic, you can do the clubs, you can do radio, you can write for panel shows and all the rest of it. And that's another outlet for writers as well. You don't have to perform. There's loads of people who make a living as a writer. There's loads of people who don't, but it's like, you don't have to be in front of an audience. You can. And there's some people that just prefer just to be writers. They don't want to have that profile thing going on. So I just wanted to add that as well, just to give a bit of another perspective to it.
We like it. We like it. Well, listen, thank you all very much for joining me and talking to me on my comedy special. Andy Osho, British comedian. Dr. Chris Ritchie, lecturer on comedy degree course at Solent University. Bruce Hills, down the line from Montreal, the COO of the comedy of the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival. Bruce, thank you.
Thank you.
And Brett Vincent, a comedy agent. Thank you all very much for joining us. Cool. And we'll play in some canned laughter. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. With gloomy forecasts worldwide, an economic recession, the desire for nostalgia and a smattering of schmaltz is clear to see. Just look at the nominees for this year's Academy Awards and BAFTAs. So London's South Bank has just played host to the first ever comedy film festival, or Loco, as they call it. Its aim is not only to host a diverse range of comedy features and shorts, but to champion the genre as a whole. That means educational workshops with industry specialists, educational outreach, and a development fund for future filmmakers. Is that funny? Emma Gilbert reports.
In the last weekend of January, the BFI played host to the first ever London Comedy Film Festival. The brainchild of two ex-colleagues and devotees of the comedy genre, Jonathan Wakem and Denise Hicks were determined to give comedy a forum all of its own, where the craft can be celebrated and great comedy films rescreened and appreciated.
Jonathan and I actually went to see a film at Somerset House, at the Somerset screening. We started talking about how great it would be to do something in film and to do something around a festival, and looking at the market and where there was a gap in the market, and actually started discussing comedy. We didn't know of a comedy film festival. I think there's one in the south of France. And we said, hang on, this is really interesting. Maybe there's something here. And the more we looked into it, the more fascinating it became. And the more meetings we had, it just grew and grew as an idea. And it turned from an event into a festival, into an entire organization, into what has now become a bit of a rallying cry and a cause. You'd be amazed how many people have come up to us and said, I was going to start a comedy film festival.
Hey, Andy, guess what?
What?
I woke up this morning, I felt a little bit, what's it, you know, and I thought to myself, oh, blimey, don't tell me I'm in the family way.
Jesus Christ.
What's a family way supposed to mean?
You know what it means.
No, I know what pregnant means.
You don't have to talk some rubbish.
Well, silly little saying.
Oh, shut up.
You shut up.
A clip from Mike Lee's Life is Sweet there. Loco also features an Edgar Wright takeover. Edgar is one of the most influential homegrown contemporary comedy writers. Jonathan explains.
Yes, when we sat down with Edgar to discuss his double bill, clearly he's always asked to play Shaun of the Dead along with An American Werewolf in London, or along with The Howling, or along with, you know, other zombie horror movies. And he said, well, I don't want to do that. I've done that dozens of times. What I want to show it alongside is the film that really inspired it. And that film is Mike Lee's Life is Sweet. Because he said when Simon Pegg and I were writing it, what was always on our mind was what would happen if zombies invaded in the middle of a Mike Lee film. And so the realism and the grounding of the characters was really, really important to the success of Shaun of the Dead. And the reason it works as a zombie film is because you understand the characters and they feel real, and therefore you care about them. Whereas most zombie films, you know, the characters are kind of cardboard cutouts, so you just can't wait for them to die.
What sets the festival apart is its dedication to nurturing talent. Kicking off with Low College, a two-day course for burgeoning comedy filmmakers, there are also masterclasses and craft sessions run by industry commissioners. For the rising talent desperately trying to secure funding or shape that first script, there is no other event offering such specialised opportunities. As Kate Herron, a young writer and director, explains.
Coming to these festivals is great because you meet people and you make contacts, and maybe it might not lead to like a paid job, but it's always someone to maybe like a new writing partner. I mean, that's how stuff gets made. Well, it's fantastic because comedy should be taken seriously. It's a really hard genre to write, and when you get it right, it's brilliant. I think a lot of people sometimes brush off comedy because they don't necessarily consider the wide spectrum of comedy films. Like, I mean, The Descendants, the Oscar-nominated Alexander Payne film now, I mean, that's a comedy, like, mixed with drama, but yeah, I think it's great. It's good to, like, feel supported.
Support is clearly central to Loco's ethos. Jonathan Wakeham again.
For Denise and I, it was always really important that Loco was more than a festival. You know, Loco is a movement. It's about kickstarting the careers of young British comedy filmmakers. And the two most important parts of that, I guess, are the Discovery screening, which is an annual screening of the festival for a new British feature film that doesn't yet have distribution. And that's a chance to give, you know, an unknown director, writer, actor, producer a chance to have their film shown on the same screen, in the same building as really big established names like Edgar Wright or the Muppets. And going forward, we want to set up the Loco Development Fund, because the most useful place to give money in the film industry is development. That's where you can pay a young writer a few thousand pounds that just gives him, you know, a few extra months of work to create a few more drafts of the script, because that's what it takes to make great comedy.
We hear from a young director whose film is being featured as part of the Discovery strand.
I'm Louis Hudson. I'm a 2D animation director, and I'm also known as Dice Productions. I think this is the perfect festival, and it's incredible that a festival hasn't existed like this before. The whole atmosphere of the festival is about recognising how difficult it is to make comedy, and everyone has repeatedly said today that all good comedy films have every single quality of all the best films that have ever been made, plus they have to make people laugh, otherwise they fail. And I think that's a testament to how great comedy is. It always wins. Online world and the ability to show whatever you want to whatever audience you want is the great aggregator. And things like Twitter means that everyone is on an equal and everyone has the same ability to contact people or have an audience. However, if you want to get onto TV, that's a completely different audience and a massive new breakthrough. You can do that through online, but there's a lot to be said for the real world, and festivals like this bring people back into the real world.
I mean, everything stops for a fire engine.
Hello.
A clip there from the rarely seen British classic Go to Blazes, which closes the festival, alongside a lost film of British cinema, originally written for British comedy giant Tony Hancock by Ray Galton and Alan Simpson. The Day Off tells the story of a London bus conductor and his 24 hours of freedom. Originally rejected by Hancock at the height of his fame, the script was shelved. Until now. With a stellar cast of comedians, Sarah Pascoe and Kevin Eldon, the London Comedy Film Festival is staging a full reading of the script. So what is next on the agenda? Jonathan again.
Today London, tomorrow the world. It's been very exciting. I mean, I think we've already had offers to run local events in Portugal and in Spain and in Los Angeles and Berlin. I'd love to do Berlin. Barcelona, in Seville, in New York and in Los Angeles. So we would like to take it international. We want to do more screenings, and I think next year's festival will have a much more international flavour.
So it looks as if the Loco brand has international reach. Never before has comedy been so critiqued, championed, celebrated and hopefully created under one roof. It seems that comedy has finally found a home.
That was Emma Gilbert reporting for Culture here on Monocle 24. Stay tuned, because after this short pause, we'll be hearing how the satirists from the world's top publications are celebrating the impending apocalypse.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much about other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now it's time for a dash of media. In keeping with our comedy theme, we decided to get ourselves along to an event that promised laughs and wry reflection. Inside the Cavernous Terrace Gallery at Artisphere in Arlington, Virginia, a local journo band comprised of reporters and politicos are soundchecking. It's Apocalyptune 2012. Amy Blazik gives us a tour.
According to the Mayan calendar, this year may mark the end of life as we know it. But the only cataclysmic event we're interested in tonight is Apocalyptune 2012. Renowned editorial and political cartoonists have picked their most ominous works to exhibit here in celebration of the looming apocalypse.
What we try to do is that we try to have a humorous outlook on the year to come.
That's Tatiana Pastakova, host of the event and half the creative mind behind Art Soiree. The organization takes art, be it performance, painting, photography, or even graffiti, and infuses it with an afterparty. What comes out the other side is a soiree where anywhere from 100 to 7,000 locals crowd around, clinking glasses, bottles, and appreciating a little culture. Pastakova says the Mayan apocalypse isn't the only big event to appreciate this year.
There are a lot of elections coming up in many countries. We're looking at Olympics, we're looking at other major events coming up in this year. And I think that the 8 cartoonists that we're featuring did an amazing job in trying to portray that.
The cartoons deal with a wide range of issues, from gas prices to the nuclear threat from Iran. But elections in the U.S. are clearly on the forefront, especially for Daryl Cagle. He's the editorial cartoonist for MSNBC.com. Cagle says he gets a lot of flack for using the animal representatives of the U.S. political parties.
Some of them say, oh, you're an old-fashioned dinosaur cartoonist, you do the donkeys and elephants. But I love the donkeys and elephants because you can apply so much character to the political parties with just a little bit of expression and body language.
One of the cartoons Cagle has on display illustrates the refusal of Democrats and Republicans to move on the budget. He's drawn the Democratic donkey clad in a dark suit with blue tie, pointing to his similarly dressed colleague from across the proverbial aisle, the GOP elephant clad in red tie. The donkey says, raise taxes. The elephant trumpets back, cut spending. Visually, it's very apparent neither will budge from the long and complex root system extending from the trunk of both figures, firmly planted in the ground. Cagle says it may be a cartoon, but it's not really a joke. He calls it a visual metaphor.
There's a donkey, the elephant, they got all these roots, they're not going anywhere. That's the way it is. I hit you on the head with that, but it's not funny.
A cartoonist who doesn't think he's funny?
Well, that's Daryl, though, but I am funny. I'm not, like, tremendously funny, but I'm a little funny.
Tom Tolles is the Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist from The Washington Post.
You know, everybody's trying to make a point. The thing that cartoonists do differently is they try to make a serious point in a funny way.
Take Tolles' cartoon depicting President Obama seated at a table, trying to talk about the debt ceiling, to an elephant standing at a podium on the ceiling. The elephant is saying to Mr. Obama, "Excuse me, I have the floor."
I guess it's a little complicated. I mean, you can get the verbal pun, but you also have to see it.
Although Tolles says Republicans make themselves a pretty easy mark, he does try to stay fair and balanced. His colleague Kevin Cal Kelleher, political cartoonist of The Economist, says no matter how hard you try, there will always be critics.
About 85% of our contact with the public is negative. And it's because we're making fun of those people in power, and so we get a very visceral response.
Pastakova says getting a reaction is one thing that motivates her to plan events like this.
When you get a response to an art, that's a good thing because that makes people think about it. That makes people to really go deep into themselves and see where do they stand. If art doesn't provoke any kind of emotion, that's not good. It's supposed to.
For Monocle, I'm Amy Blazek at Apocalyptune 2012 in Arlington.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now, there are lots of minutes in this show, 53 and a half to be exact, but we like to think that although all of our content is of exceptionally high quality, this particular 60-second chunk really shines. That's right, it's time for our 1 minute of sound, and in keeping with our comedy theme, stand-up comic James Mullinger decided to share with us a very different side of the comedy circuit. This is what he gathered during a Saturday night corporate booking in Castleford, Northern England.
Welcome to the North. This is the sound of the average dressing room of a comedy club across the UK and indeed the world. Room full of work colleagues from Europe's leading security firm. They've decided that their mission for the evening is to make sure that you have a miserable time doing your job. Sound of the gig has been obliterated by sneaking out a fire exit to smoke before I have to go back on and close this nightmare gig, which could have been worse.
Thank you, James Mullinger. Thank you. Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
So here I am at 3 a.m. hoping for a cab, but knowing I will probably be walking the rest of the way.
That was a minute of sound from stand-up comedian James Mullinger. So that's just about all we have time for this week on Culture. Next week, we'll be exploring Denmark's exuberant and exciting music scene and getting a live session from Gianna Factory. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa and my researcher was Hannah Jenkins. Time for one final song this week from my album of the week, Imaginary Future. This is French Films with Pretty in Decadence. Thanks for tuning in.
I went to heaven to get a prize. I asked for God.